This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Colleges and universities across the country are reporting an explosion of mental health problems verging on an epidemic, according to my guests Dr. B. Janet Hibbs and Dr. Anthony Rostain. Their new book, The Stressed Years of Their Lives, is about why college students are more stressed and how parents can help their kids cope with stress and anxiety and prepare them to become independent. Dr. Hibbs is a family and couples psychotherapist. Her son took a medical leave of absence during his first college spring break to deal with anxiety and depression. When he returned home, he was treated by Dr. Rostain, who chaired the University of Pennsylvania's Task Force on Student Psychological Health and Well-Being. Dr. Rostain is a professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the university's Perelman School of Medicine and practices at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Rostain, Dr. Hibbs, welcome to Fresh Air. Dr. Rostain, I want to start with you. You say that you've seen a dramatic rise in campus mental illness rates. Describe what you're seeing on campus.
Well, we've always had students come in with anxiety and depression or adjustment disorders and having to see a counselor or a therapist or a psychiatrist to help them through a crisis. What we're seeing now are growing numbers of students coming into campus who already are being treated for mental illness, who are on various medications, and who really have, you know, learned to manage their illnesses at home, but suddenly they're on their own, and sometimes they're not following through their own recommended treatments. We're also seeing students coming on with an inordinate amount of anxiety about surviving college and doing well. And we think the anxiety levels are rising and creating in students a great amount of both distress when anything goes wrong, like more of a brittle response to challenges, a greater avoidance of risk. So people are really not wanting to move out of their comfort zone, and a real over-reliance on things like alcohol and other substances to help manage things like social anxiety. The good news, though, is that they're more aware of that, so we think more of them are coming forward to talk about it with us.
So if you're seeing more stress and anxiety in students today, what do you think are some of the causes behind those new levels of stress?
Well, we think that the culture has changed in the last 30, 40 years, and that these students are growing up in the post 9/11 era, that they've been exposed to a lot of trauma, both in the media and also in their lives, many of them. School shootings, the rise in the uncertainty from globalization, and of course the economic recession of 2008. You know, our students today were young then, and the anxiety, we think, really had an impact on their families, as well as on what they could glean from the news. And of course, being in this 24/7 news cycle, as well as the internet itself, has really created a sort of a different childhood. I mean, we can also talk, I think, about the preparation for school, that many of them have been overprepared in terms of taking tons of AP classes and really packing their CVs with all kinds of activities. And we worry that there's not enough downtime and things that they can do that are not going to necessarily always result in a grade or in someone noticing them, you know.
Dr. Hibbs, you do a lot of family therapy, so you see a lot of families before the child is going to college.
Right.
So what are some of the stressors that you're seeing in preparation for college and preparing kids to be on their own?
The overwhelming majority of high school students today, it's somewhere around 90%, report college as their top stressor. And to build on what Tony's saying, it's not only kids but their parents who are anxious. So we're living in a culture of fear. And many times parents come to me and go, what's wrong with kids today? I didn't have these kinds of stressors. And this isn't what my college experience was like. And it's important for parents to know we're in what I would call a moment of historic swerve, where basically this has been building for about 40 years. And then the thread is just spinning out, rolling out really fast now with all of the very rapid changes. And so parents have gone into a control mode. They used to promote autonomy. That's how I grew up, like the free-range kid. But now they're exerting more and more control, which makes their kids more anxious and also less prepared prepared for the unpredictable.
When you say more control, what forms of control?
Parents are scared that there's only one path, a linear path to the good life. And so for some parents who are affluent enough, that means a brand name college or the top, you know, prep that you can get. For other parents, it's just a lot of pressure on the kids. You have to do well. You can't make a mistake. Your chances will be ruined. So we see, especially with very smart kids, which some researchers call brainiacs, they have what we call destructive perfectionism, which they cannot tolerate, not excelling at everything. And no one, I mean, typically excels at everything. We all have, you know, times when we both make mistakes or fail, and kids don't have as much practice at that today because they're protected from having those experiences, and also it freaks their parents out, which makes then the kids feel more responsible.
I want to get to something that you mentioned, which is a lot of parents feel like, I don't know, when I went to college, I was so happy to get away from my parents and to be independent. So why is my child so reluctant to leave home? Why are they having such a hard time adjusting to being away from home? And I'd like you each to reflect on that a little bit, because I think it is baffling to a lot of parents.
I think most kids are still really happy to leave home.
For sure.
They want to be in the life of the pseudo-adult. But what they're unprepared for are what I would call both the expectable challenges that college poses in terms of the requirement for more independence, more ownership of your hours, whether it's sleep, saying no to partying, managing yourself, basically. And it also is the fact that parents' remembrance is that it was less pressure. That's absolutely true. It's a much harsher environment now. It's the same number of slots at these top competitive schools, a lot more applicants. And part of what's also going on is that as the College for All movement rolled out 45 years ago, it dismantled vocational funding at the federal and community college levels and even at the public university levels. The underlying message is there's only one path to a good life. And so the pressure on kids who've really, you know, drunk the Kool-Aid, that's the message they believe, is that they'll have, as one of the kids I've treated says, a second-tier life unless they just keep going to the top schools of everything. And even then, they feel they cannot make mistakes.
It's all about expectations. Now, there's a certain amount of inevitable anxiety about transition. I mean, we call this age the transitional age period of transitional age youth. So that we think is natural, the feeling that, oh, I don't know quite what I'm doing here. But it's the response that they're having to that uncertainty that we've noticed students have a lot less resilience or preparation. So that's part of what we're trying to do in this book, is really talk about readiness, social emotional readiness. There's no question people are academically prepared. I mean, they're learning incredible amount nowadays in school. They're learning amazing kinds of things. And the internet has opened up knowledge that was never as available, you know, but it's also created distractions and a lot of pressure socially. And more importantly, I think when people get to college, maybe not enough time has been spent in high school, both in the curricular side and with the family, in what we call social emotional readiness or maturity.
How do you teach that? I mean, what do you mean by preparation? How do you prepare somebody for emotional maturity?
Again, going back to the comparisons, you know, in the past, we'd go off to college. Sometimes our parents would drop us off, but that's it. Say goodbye and you're there.
Once a week phone call.
Yeah, once a week phone call, if you were lucky, right? Now it's constant, you know, texting and Skyping and talking to one another. So there's a lot of closeness, and we're not against closeness. What happens then, though, is that the student doesn't feel like, hey, I really know how to manage this on my own, and haven't had a chance to practice. And the way you teach it is really by going through, you know, a set of conversations with your kid and saying, hey, you know, let's talk a little bit about, you know, the way you manage your life. Like, can you get up in the morning and manage your day? I mean, I run an ADHD program at Penn, and I got a phone call from a parent a few years back saying, hey, you're the director of the ADHD program. My son is coming to Penn. I said, great, wonderful. Congratulations. She says, do you have a wake-up service? I said, you have a wake-up service? Yes, my son can't get up without me getting him up every morning. And so what I said, listen, we don't have a wake-up service, but I think it's really important that he learn how to wake himself up before he gets to college. So that's really what we're saying, is learning to manage your life, learning to do things more on your own without constantly checking back and asking for someone's help, and also being able to handle things like the risks that college brings and being able to handle social relationships. All of those are conversations parents and kids really need to have in an open way.
So there's a level of helping your child that's maybe too much help.
Exactly. And it comes at a cost, right? Because, yes, we're giving our kids everything we have and we care about them, right? But at the same time, what's the message? It's, oh, you need to succeed or else we're going to really get upset. I think if the message from a parent to a kid is, look, you may not know, but we expect that you'll be able to figure it out. Let's see what happens, is different than saying, you better do this. You better know that. You better not mess up. And that the anxiety itself is part of what we want parents to deal with, their own anxiety, and then being able to let go in a way that's more feels more natural. It's okay to not know.
Dr. Hibbs, I want to talk with you about your experience with your son, who you call Jensen in the book, so we'll stick with the name Jensen. So, and Dr. Rustain, you treated him after he came home from college. So, Dr. Hibbs, your son had to take a medical leave from college, and this was during his first spring break.
Correct.
What did he tell you about why he felt he could no longer stay?
He told me that his friend told him that he had to tell us, and I say this to parents because kids usually tell their friends first. He said, I can't go back. And I asked him, are you scared you're going to hurt yourself? And he said, yes. I'm having suicidal thoughts that won't go away. And I'm scared to go back. Which then started a conversation in the den about 45 minutes before his flight was scheduled to take off.
This is right before he was leaving to go back to college?
Yes. And I called my husband in because I thought, this is not my decision alone to make. Meanwhile, my mind was shredding every bit of like data I'd ever processed about suicidal risk and arguing with myself. I'm not particularly proud of all the arguments like, we'll lose money and oh my gosh, can't he just finish? But when my husband came in, and what's characteristic of these kinds of decisions is like parents often are polarized between the mother bear, who's like, I've got to protect my kid, and the, you know, father gruff bear, oh, come on, suck it up. You can just do this for another, like, 6 weeks. And we were polarized, but I just, as my son says, put my foot down and said, we can't send him back. Like, we have to trust what he's telling us. Get me a plane ticket. I'm flying down on the next flight.
To help him pack up and
to help him
move
pack
back
up
home.
And leave. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So did this take you by surprise? Like, what was he telling you in the months preceding that about how college was going for him?
In the first semester, it had gone exceedingly well. He had a great group of friends. We met them at one of the parent weekends. His dorm was the regular hangout spot, so it was going great. He'd done really well academically. And yet, in the beginnings of the second semester, as he says, the cracks were beginning to show. He had a counselor that he had gone to, like, during part of the first semester. And he had accommodations that he decided not to use, partly because he didn't want to feel different. As he said, everybody knows why you're going in that building. So this is part of the mental health stigma that sometimes develops for kids who want to feel like, I'm fine, I don't need this. But what the other thing is even though I felt like we had done a good job of college search, there are many, many lessons I learned. As I joke with my kids, all my major monumental mistakes are very well documented in this book. I've kind of corralled them as lessons for parents that I hope they don't have to repeat this. But part of what I learned was even though we were Skyping, FaceTiming every week, and I could see him and I could hear him and I was concerned, it wasn't like I was saying, would you please show me an image of your room so I can see the piles of clothes or the Chinese takeout containers?
Yeah, tell us more what you would have seen. Like, what did you find when you went back with him?
Well, you know, so part of the question that I was asking myself was the wrong question. Can he finish? And the real question I should have been asking myself is he functioning independently anymore? Because when self-management goes, I don't get up on time, I'm not going to classes, I'm not eating in the dining hall anymore. So dining hall swipes are a huge indicator of, like, is a student socializing or have they withdrawn? So I would have seen Chinese takeout containers and a lot of dirty clothes on the floor and a lot of soda cans, Mountain Dews, because he was really trying to, like, manage his deteriorating mood by, like, pumping himself up on Mountain Dew and manage, you know, kind of the social effect of things that he felt terrible, just to, like, I'm too depressed to be around people even when they invite me out. But as he describes it, the depression came on so gradually it felt normal, like suffering became the norm.
At some point, you went to Dr. Rothstein.
Yes.
In spite of the fact that your son already had psychiatrists.
Yes.
Therapists he'd been working
yes.
with. So Jensen was eventually diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
That's
was
right.
that your diagnosis,
yes,
Dr. Rothstein?
Mm-hmm.
And what made you think it was bipolar as opposed to various, you know, other things that he'd been diagnosed with along
partly
the way?
It was
anxiety
the,
disorder.
Yeah. He had a different type of bipolar disorder. He had never become manic, but he did have what we call bipolar 2 disorder, where he had had periods of time where he was feeling really good before this crash. He was also non-responsive and actually made worse by antidepressants. So we ended up—
Does that happen? Can
that happens in bipolar disorder, yes. And so he ended up having a bipolar depression that began to get better when we put him on the right medication.
So Dr. Hibbs, I want to get your reaction to this. So you find out through this, like, family therapy that Dr. Rothstein is mm-hmm. organizing for you and your son, you find out through that that your son thinks you sometimes infantilize him. And you've been trying so hard to, like, help him. You're so worried about him. So what was your reaction to hearing that? And I'll reiterate, you're a psychologist who deals with, you know, family therapy yourself.
Well, to paraphrase Victor Hugo, no matter the position of the body, my soul was on its knees. And I was open to hearing anything that would be helpful. It was an unpredictably enriching experience in the sense that I became a more patient person. I became less reactive. I became more accepting of what my son wanted for himself, not what I wanted for him. It's not that I gave up hope or dreams for him, but I became more present. But during the time in which he was in therapy with Dr. Rothstein, and it was a very frightening time, it was as harrowing for me as it was humbling, I learned what I didn't know. And I became more accepting of, okay, you really don't want to go back to college. I mean, he's, you know, finished about 3 years and kind of went, yeah, I'm done. I want to be a creative writer. Kind of went, yeah, you kind of need a day job, but I don't know what that's going to be. But all right, you don't want to go back to college. So here I am with like 8 years of graduate training, 2 masters, a PhD going, oh, you don't want to go back to college. Okay.
I think that's something a lot of parents face who have higher education.
Yeah.
And are working professionals,
right.
And their children don't want
that
kind of education. They're not looking for that kind of life. And don't you think a lot of parents find that very, like, both baffling and disturbing?
I would say to those parents, please trust your child. Your child is the expert on himself or herself. We are 20th century parents giving advice to 21st century kids. They've inherited a brave new world that we never lived in. And not to spoil the, you know, not to make a spoiler, but he's doing really well on a path that I would have never predicted, that I could have never foreseen, because I was a follow-your-nose academic, and that's not what he wanted to be.
So we've done this interview in kind of two parts, part talking more generally about the stresses students, college students, and their parents face during the college years. And then we talk specifically, Dr. Hibbs, about your son and mm-hmm. your story trying to help him, mm-hmm. and sometimes doing the wrong thing in the process.
Yep.
And Dr. Estain, your work in treating Dr. Hibbs' son. So Dr. Estain is somebody who's a bit of an outsider here in Dr. Hibbs' son's story. What are some of the takeaways that you see for other parents of college-age children, for other college-age students who are listening now?
Well, to start with, I think growing up is a complicated process, and we all have to recognize that we're all still going through changes. So parents have to adapt to the idea of their child growing up and of letting go, and if they're anxious about it, to try to figure out why and to be more mindful about their reactions and to try to be less reactive and more responsive when things are not going as hoped for. Okay, it's fine your kid goes off to school and they're successful, everybody feels good, but what if there's a setback? What if things don't go as planned? How do you prepare yourself for that by simply reminding yourself that there is no straight line through life? And, you know, I shared my own story in the book where I had to leave college for a while, and it really saved my life, okay, because I was all gung-ho about going to college, and I wasn't prepared for it. And so the second thing I want to say is time off may help. Sometimes it's better to just take a step back, get your game back to where you want it to be. And then the third is don't be afraid of getting help from mental health professionals. We're here to work with you and with your kid, and we're not here to blame you or to condemn you, you know. And so many parents face this fear of the shame or the embarrassment or the stigma. And what we think is the most deadly thing of all is not the mental illness, but the stigma around it that leads people to avoid getting the help in time.
I want to thank you both so much. Dr. Hibbs, Dr. Estain, thank you.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you. Our pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Janet Hibbs and Dr. Anthony Rostain are the authors of the new book, The Stressed Years of Their Lives. That's Taron Egerton portraying Elton John in the new biopic, Rocketman. Egerton had performed a cover of Elton John's I'm Still Standing in the 2016 animated musical Sing. Rocketman also features performances by Jamie Bell, Richard Madden, and Bryce Dallas Howard, and was directed by Dexter Fletcher, who did uncredited work on last year's Freddie Mercury biopic, Bohemian Rhapsody. Film critic Justin Chang has this review of Rocketman.
The first time we see Elton John in Rocketman, he's wearing a spangly red devil costume with sharp horns and enormous wings. It's one of the many glorious, glittery things we see him wear in the movie, although on this occasion, he isn't dressed for a concert. It's around 1990, and Elton, played by Taron Egerton, is attending a group therapy session. He may be one of the world's most successful rock stars, but he's also being eaten alive by sex addiction and substance abuse, and also by feelings of abandonment that go back to his childhood. No one who's seen a movie about a popular musician will be surprised by any of this, or by the way Rocketman unfolds its story as a series of extended flashbacks. But even within that familiar framework, the movie finds surprising ways to buck convention. The colors are bright and kaleidoscopic, but the tone is beautifully modulated. The operatic excesses are balanced by a powerful sense of melancholy. The group therapy framing device works especially well. The sight of Elton in all that defiant plumage is ludicrous, marvelous, and strangely poignant, all words you might apply to the movie itself. As directed by Dexter Fletcher from a script by Lee Hall, Rocketman isn't just a musician's biopic, it's a biographical musical. Conceived as a surreal song-and-dance spectacular, it's a delirious blur of truth and artifice, convention and daring. John's greatest hits, from Your Song and Tiny Dancer to Goodbye Yellow Brick Road and I'm Still Standing, are treated not just as career milestones, but as full-blown numbers. The first one is The Bitch Is Back, repurposed here as an anthem of boyhood defiance for Elton, born Reginald Dwight, as he grows up in 1950s London with his unhappily married parents. Bryce Dallas Howard plays his mother with a series of exhausted eye rolls, even when Reggie begins to show signs of prodigious musical talent. Reggie grows up in a flash, rebrands himself as Elton John, and meets his lifelong collaborator, the lyricist Bernie Taupin, wonderfully played by Jamie Bell. The movie's most stirring scene finds Elton improvising at the piano, and the immortal melody to Your Song comes pouring out of his fingertips. It's his song of unrequited love for Bernie, who will stand by him through thick and thin, even after Elton falls into a toxic relationship with a manipulative manager, John Reed, played by Richard Madden of Game of Thrones fame. It may be a little reductive to use John's music as a form of narrative shorthand, but it also works like gangbusters. We're reminded of just how soulful and emotionally malleable that music is. In one of the more blatant but inspired artistic liberties, Elton makes his stateside debut at the Troubadour in L.A. with a gravity-defying performance of Crocodile Rock. Never mind that it's 1970, 2 years before he and Taupin would write that song in real life.
I remember when rock was young, me and Susie had so much fun, holding hands and skimming on stones. Had no girl to be in a place of my own.
That's Taron Egerton doing his own singing. And while the 29-year-old actor isn't a perfect physical match for Elton John, it hardly matters. Rather than going for showy mimicry, Egerton underplays, locating subtle depths of feeling in a figure known for his flamboyance. He retains a firm grip on the character even when he begins his downward spiral, climaxing with his 1975 suicide attempt when he overdoses on Valium and plunges into his swimming pool. It's here that director Fletcher unleashes the song Rocket Man itself, staged as a gorgeously lyrical underwater fantasy. Moments like that give the movie a coherence and fluidity that eluded the much more slapdash Bohemian Rhapsody, which Fletcher completed after its director, Bryan Singer, was fired mid-production. It's hard not to compare the two. Like Rhapsody, Rocket Man is a portrait of an LGBT glam rock icon who repressed his sexuality but ultimately couldn't keep it out of the spotlight. This movie, to its credit, takes a much more intimate and empathetic view of its subject's romantic life. That's not to say that Rocket Man doesn't have its overly processed, sanitized moments. You may nod your head somewhat dutifully as the story tumbles through its rise and fall and rise again trajectory. But as Elton John's music itself reminds us, even the most familiar tune can take on new resonance. In the movie's most aching moments, Elton seems to be singing not to others but to himself, as if to suggest that even the most universal pleasures often have intensely personal roots. Before it was Your Song, it was his.
Justin Chang is a film critic at the LA Times. Coming up, Daniel Okrent tells us about a chapter of American history when the junk science of eugenics merged with immigration law to keep Jews, Italians, and Eastern Europeans out of the country. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about an earlier part of immigration history when, as my guest Daniel Okrent writes, a perverse form of science gave respectability to the drastic limits imposed on the number of Jews, Italians, Greeks, Poles, and various other Eastern and Southern Europeans seeking to come to America. The, quote, science was eugenics, which theorized that traits like intelligence and morality were inherited, and therefore, through selective breeding, you could improve the quality of the human race. Of course, the converse was also believed to be true. Certain individuals or groups of people would pollute the bloodline. Those undesirables were the people the restrictive immigration law of 1924 was designed to keep out. Okrent is the author of the new book, The Guarded Gate: Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. He hears the rhetoric of that era echoing today. Daniel Okrent, welcome back to Fresh Air. Did you write about anti-immigration movements of the past to put President Trump's hardline immigration policies into historical context?
No, I can't say that I did. That just happened to be an unfortunate coincidence, or maybe commercially a fortunate coincidence. I began to write this book because I stumbled across the story of eugenics in America in the early part of the 20th century. And as I looked further into it, in addition to those things that many people have written about, particularly planned breeding and sterilization, I stumbled across this immigration story where eugenics was used as a primary weapon in the effort to keep Southern and Eastern Europeans out of the country, resulting in a law passed in 1924 in place for 41 years that really gave the lie to the notion that we were a nation of immigrants.
So your grandparents, like so many Americans' grandparents or great-grandparents, came to the U.S. in the early 1900s before the restrictive 1924 Act. Tell us a little bit what immigration from Europe or Eastern Europe was like then. What did it take to get entry into America?
To get entry into America before the 1921 Act, you needed to get on a boat, come across the ocean, show up at Ellis Island, and not have a contagious disease or any other very obvious disability or a criminal record or be suspected of certain criminal activities. But beyond that, the door was wide, wide open to the huddled masses that Emma Lazarus wrote about.
So before the restrictive immigration laws that we'll be talking about momentarily, the immigrants that were considered good immigrants and immigrants that were considered dirty, filthy, stupid immigrants, what was the dividing line?
Well, it depends on who's doing the considering, but I think we're talking specifically about the Protestant elites of the Northeast, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, who had enormous political power at the time. And they saw immigrants coming from the countries that they had come from and people of similar ethnic background, which is to say the countries of Northwestern Europe, the UK, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, Germany, all Protestant countries. They were okay. And those who were coming from the Catholic and the Jewish countries were simply not. And that was almost universal, except, I suppose, for France. But the Eastern and Southern Europeans were looked upon by some of these people as really less than human. And the sociologist Edward Ross, who was later the national chairman of the American Civil Liberties Union, he described, this is, you know, a very liberal and progressive man, he described looking at the immigrants, the Eastern European immigrants in Union Square in New York, and seeing what he described as hirsute, low-browed, big-faced persons of obviously low mentality, ox-like people who clearly belong in skins, in wattled huts at the close of the Ice Age. It's a pretty terrifying image and characteristic of those who wish to close the door.
So let's talk about the science of, the junk science of eugenics.
Thank
you. So what was the, you know, like pseudoscientific basis of this?
The origin of eugenics is in England in the latter half of the 19th century. It really comes out of Darwin in a way, out of some very good science. Darwin upsets the entire balance of the scientific world with his discovery and propagation of the ideas of evolution. And then once you establish that we are not all derived from the same people, from Adam and Eve, which was the prevailing view of the time, then we learn that we are not all the same. We are not all brothers, if you wish to take that particular position. And the early eugenicists believed that and thought that we could control the nature of the population of a nation, the UK at first or the US, by selective breeding. Let's have only the good breed with the good, and let's not let the less than good breed. Francis Galton, who was actually a cousin of Darwin's, who was the man who named eugenics and was its first most vocal advocate, he suggested early on that the UK find the 5,000 best young men and the 5,000 best young women and pair them off in arranged marriages, which would take place in one huge ceremony in Westminster Abbey, presided over by Queen Victoria. And each of these families, these new couples, would be given a yearly stipend. So instead of working, they could get down to the business of making better people, better babies for the UK. Now, this was a kind of a positive view in a way, but it implied the opposite that became popular in the U.S., that we have to stop the reproduction of those who don't improve our so-called race, who don't make the country a better place. And this negative form of eugenics is the one that begins to bubble into popularity in the U.S. around 1910, 1912.
So it wasn't just like intelligence that was considered to be an inherited trait. It was like morality.
Yeah, that's a really stunning thing. You find some very well-established scientists, Fairfield Osborne, the head of the American Museum of Natural History for 25 years, he outright declared that it is not just intelligence, it is also morality that is inherited and criminality is inherited. And it's really stunning to think that people who are very, very well-credentialed in the natural sciences could believe these things. But if you begin your belief by thinking that certain peoples are inferior to other peoples, it's very easy to adapt your science to suit your own prejudice.
And the eugenicists had ways of evaluating which ethnic groups were the smartest and which were the idiots. Let's talk a little bit about some of those tests. Go ahead.
Well, there were any number of tests in various places, almost all of them of equal unreliability to determine whether people were of sufficient intelligence. One of the most famous ones was the so-called alpha test that was given to nearly 2 million soldiers in World War I by Robert M. Yerkes, who is now memorialized in the Yerkes Primate Research Center in Atlanta, federal facility. Yerkes gave tests that included questions that were sort of almost Jeopardy questions, although in reverse. You know, a question like, is Bud Fisher a, choose one, outfielder, cartoonist, or novelist? Now, if you've just been in the country for 5 years and you don't speak English terribly well, how are you possibly going to answer a question like that? But it was taken seriously as a measure of intelligence to such a degree that Carl Brigham, who later became famous for inventing the SAT, a Princeton psychologist, he said, well, these are the kind of questions, if you know the answers, it shows that you've been in America and you're an American, and that's what we're trying to establish. We're trying to find people who deserve to be in America.
I'm going to mention a couple of other questions here because these are just,
They're
incredible.
They're pretty great.
Yeah, okay. The Wyandotte is a kind of horse, fowl, cattle, or granite.
All right. I'm thinking really hard. The beads of sweat are forming on my forehead. I'm going to go with cattle.
You're wrong. I looked it up.
See?
There's a Wyandotte chicken.
So kick me out of the country. I don't deserve
really,
to be here by
not.
The standards.
You do not. Mm-hmm. Okay. In 1924... a new immigration act is passed that is very exclusionary. And you say it marked the culmination of 3 decades of agitation and debate about immigration. What were the restrictions or quotas that were set up for different groups?
There are 2 parts to it. First, there's an overall quota. At various times, it was 300,000 people. Then it got chopped down to, I believe it was 162,000 people. But the question, the second part, is where did these people come from? And it was decided that, well, let's continue to reflect the population of America as it has become. So we will decide where people can come from based on how many people of their same nationality were already here. So to use really reductive, simple math, if 10% of the current American population came from country A, then 10% of that year's immigrants could come from country A. Except, and this is probably the most malign and dishonest thing that came out of this entire movement, they didn't do this on the basis of the 1920 census, which had been conducted just 4 years before, or the 1910, or even the 1900. But those numbers were based on the population in 1890, before the large immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe had begun. So to any question about whether there was any racist or anti-Semitic or anti-Italian intent, this established that there clearly was. Let's find that moment in history that keeps out more of these people than any other. So if you take the Italians, in the year before the first of the quota laws went into effect, more than 220,000 Italians came into the U.S. And the year after, under the quota, it was fewer than 4,000. And similar numbers stretched across Eastern and Southern Europe. Suddenly, the door had slammed in the faces of those people who had been coming in the largest numbers, based not only on bogus science, but based on a manipulation of American history itself. It had to be based on, they said, on the 1890 population, and the intent of that was clear. One of the really interesting consequences of this, if you read the 38 articles, I think it's about 20 pages of small type in the 1924 Immigration Act, you do not see anywhere the words Italian or Jew or Greek or Turk or Pole. They don't have to mention the countries because they have this absolutely innocent-seeming numerical equation to rely upon.
So did the eugenics movement directly figure into the passage of the Immigration Act of 1924?
Unquestionably. It made it a palatable act because it was based on science or presumed science. This isn't prejudice. We love these people, but they are not as good as we are. I think there would have been a restriction law in any case, but this cleansed the restriction law, and I think cemented it into place in a way that it otherwise might not have been.
It's fascinating to read in your book how Hitler and the Nazis were drawing on the American eugenics movement to, like, strengthen their own movements. They were almost using some of the American eugenics, quote, findings as guidelines for themselves. You know, Hitler becomes chancellor in 1933, but he writes Mein Kampf, or at least he publishes it, in 1925, which is 1 year after the Immigration Act of 1924 is passed. And you cite a passage from Mein Kampf in which Hitler directly refers to America.
He refers as the United States as the one, this is a quote, one state in which at least weak beginnings toward a better conception of citizenship are noticeable. Among them, simply excluding certain races from naturalization. And from there, he goes on to quote in later speeches and writings, Madison Grant becomes a hero of his. And most importantly, the American eugenicists, even the most respectable of them, had for, by the time Hitler takes power in 1932-33, for nearly three decades, the German eugenicists and the American eugenicists had been working together to develop their presumed science. They were collaborators in a more respectable sense of the word, but then the collaboration becomes deadly and awful once Hitler takes over. In 1933, addressing a convention of doctors who were engaged in eugenic research, he said, "I cannot do without you for a single day, not a single hour. If not for you, if you fail me, then all is lost." And the all was his entirely eugenic view of mankind, the superiority of the Aryan race, the deficiency of various peoples who had disabilities that brought on the euthanasia of hundreds of thousands. It all kind of flows directly from the previous research.
So the Nazis were in part inspired by the American eugenics movement and the 1924 Exclusionary Immigration Act. But World War II basically killed off the eugenics movement as a reputable movement.
Yes, I think that by the time we are fully aware of the depredations of Hitler and the Nazis, eugenics has suffered a fatal wound. There were remnants that continued, and there are remnants that continue today. But as a meaningful social presence, it was gone.
So let's jump ahead to the present. I know you wrote this book not expecting it to coincide with Trump's hardline policies and rhetoric on immigration. But the book does coincide with that now. So does his rhetoric about Mexicans and South Americans coming to the U.S. and his insistence on building a wall on the southern border, does that echo themes of the earlier anti-immigration movements?
Very much so, particularly the singling out of people by nationality. I think that one could say that today's Central Americans and today's Muslims, let's please not forget that, are the equivalent of 1924's Jews and Italians, or reverse it. The Jews and Italians then were treated and regarded as these Latin American and Muslim nationalities are today. When you choose your immigrants, when you choose your next-door neighbors on the basis of their ethnicity or their race, rather than the nature of the individual, him or herself, you're engaged in this case, official legal discrimination.
Is there any specific rhetoric that you hear echoes of the past in today?
I think that the rhetoric of criminality, the attribution of criminality not to individual criminals but to hundreds of thousands of people of various nationalities, that's very similar to the notion of moral deficiency that was hurled by the eugenicists at the Southern and Eastern Europeans of the 19-teens and 20s.
So do you think that if there's been a constant strain in American history, and sometimes it's hidden and sometimes it's visible, and sometimes it's small and sometimes it's larger, but nevertheless a constant strain of xenophobia and anti-Semitism and, of course, racism?
It goes back to the 18th century. Benjamin Franklin wrote with horror about the Germans who were moving into Pennsylvania in the 1750s and how both they and their language were corrupting influences on the colony of Pennsylvania. It never goes away. It moves in cycles. And the xenophobia, the first expression is, we are the land of the free, our doors are open, come sit beside the golden door, you huddled masses yearning to breathe free. And then the next expression is, keep out. And then that goes away, and back comes the more open view of it. In 1965, when Johnson signed the Hart-Celler Act, which ended the Quota Act of 1924, as I write in the book, I said, the future of open immigration for those who really believed in non-discriminatory open immigration, it looked as bright as the brilliant sun overhead as he signed it on Liberty Island and sitting next to the Statue of Liberty. That's 50 years ago, and it looked great, and now it doesn't look so great, and let's hope that that version will come back soon enough.
Daniel Okrent, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Daniel Okrent is the author of The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. This edition of Fresh Air Weekend was produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Muj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.